A traveling salesman left for dead. Just how did Travis Alexander's life come to this tragic ending? Who was the killer? And was it murder in cold blood, or was it self-defense? It's a case that captured the minds of millions and to this day still divides many on what they believe really happened. The Jody Arias story, today on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Travis Victor Alexander was an American salesman who was murdered by his ex-girlfriend Jody Ann Arias in his house in Mesa, Arizona. Arias was convicted of first-degree murder on May 8, 2013, and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole on April 13, 2015. At the time of the murder, Alexander sustained 27 knife wounds and a gunshot to the head. Arias testified that she killed him in self-defense, but she was convicted by the jury. The murder and trial received widespread media attention in the United States. Travis Victor Alexander was born on July 28, 1977 in Riverside, California, to Gary David Alexander and Pamela Elizabeth Morgan Alexander. At the age of 11, Travis moved in with his parental grandparents. After his father's death in July 1997, his seven siblings were also taken in by their parental grandmother. Alexander was a salesman and motivational speaker for prepaid legal services. Jody Ann Arias was born July 9, 1980, in Salinas, California, to William and Sandra Arias. His father is of Mexican ancestry, and her mother is of German and English ancestry. Arias and Alexander met in September of 2006 at a PPL conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. Arias converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, of which Alexander was a member, and was baptized by him on November 26, 2006, in a ceremony in Southern California. Alexander and Arias began dating in February of 2007. Arias moved to Mesa to live closer to Alexander. In April of 2008, she moved to Eureka, California, and lived there with her grandparents. Alexander and Arias dated intermittently for a year and a half, often in a long-distance relationship, taking turns traveling between their respective Arizona and California homes. Alexander's friends, who knew Arias and observed them together, tended to have a negative opinion of her, stating that the relationship was unusually tumultuous and that Arias' behavior was worrying. It is, of course, the dark side of Wikipedia. Thank you for joining us. If you like the program, please be sure to press the subscribe button wherever you may be listening. We greatly appreciate that. This is a story I remember hearing the name Jody Arias a lot, roughly 8-9 years ago, but it's a story I never really paid a whole lot of attention to. So a lot of this, other than just knowing this name exists, is going to be new to me as we kind of dig into it. It's Tony and Carol Hughes on today's episode of Dark Side of Wikipedia. What's your remembrance of the case yourself?
Well, you know, I watched a documentary or two on it.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you right up front, I think she did it. I know she did it.
You're spoiling it.
And she is crazy. That's just my opinion. I think the woman is batshit crazy.
Yeah.
But no, almost like crazy in that it's, I mean, obviously what she's capable of, but crazy in a really frightening way.
I think you're influencing the jury.
Just telling you what I think.
Yeah, no, and that's good. And that's something to keep in mind when listening to it, to kind of get a better idea of what we're dealing with. Because some of these, when I don't know them, and if it's, you know, a listener out there who doesn't know it either, I'm kind of intrigued because you don't know all the time. It's not because every story is not like, oh, the person is a horrible person and, you know, they had it coming, or or sometimes it is. You just, these stories are everywhere and they swing both ways now so frequently. You never know what the hell you're going to get. And there's usually 50 plot twists along the way as well.
And this one has those.
Great. I'm excited. Well, let's.
But I mean, you know, and I think there's times in all these stories where even when it's like, okay, Ted Bundy. Mm-hmm. But then you're listening to the story and it's like, well, I can see why his girlfriend didn't think it was him. Or,
yeah,
you know, you can kind of see how someone can also not believe that someone's capable of it.
Sure.
You know, and then there's other times we've done these where I'm like, I don't know. I really don't know. But this one had enough press and was like in the headlines for such a long time. Mm-hmm. Well, that a lot of people are going to have opinions about this one.
Well, let's dive into it and learn more about what Wikipedia tells us about the Jodi Arias story here on today's episode. Alexander was murdered on Wednesday, June 4th, 2008. He sustained 27 to 29 stab wounds, a slit throat and gunshot wound to the head. Medical examiner Kevin Horn testified that Alexander's jugular vein, common carotid artery, and trachea had been slashed and that Alexander had defensive wounds on his hands. Horn further testified that Alexander must have been dead at the time the gunshot was inflicted and that the back wounds were shallow. Alexander's death was ruled a homicide. He was buried at Riverside's Olivewood Memorial Park Cemetery. In early 2008, Alexander told people that Arias would join him for a work-related trip to Cancun, Mexico, scheduled for June 15th. In April, Alexander asked to change his travel companion to another female friend. On May 28th, a burglary occurred at the residence of Arias' grandparents, with whom Arias was living. Among the missing objects was a .25-caliber automatic Colt pistol, which was never recovered. This later became significant as a shell case from a spent .25-caliber round was found near Alexander's body at the murder scene. On June 2nd, between 11 a.m. and 3 a.m., Arias called Alexander four times, but did not appear to get through to him. Since the longest of the calls was 17 seconds, after 3 a.m., Alexander called Arias twice, the first time for 18 minutes, the second time for 41 minutes. At 4.03 a.m., Arias called Alexander back and the call lasted 2 minutes, 48 seconds. Neither these calls nor their transcripts were presented in Arias' trial. At 5.39 a.m., Arias set out to drive south to rent a car for a long trip to Utah, as shown by evidence of a gasoline purchase in Eureka. On June 2nd at 8.04 a.m., Arias rented a car in Redding, California. She indicated she'd return the car to Redding. Arias visited friends in Southern California on her way to Utah for a PPL work conference and to meet with Ryan Burns, a PPL co-worker. By late evening on June 3rd, Arias apparently set out for Salt Lake City. Alexander missed an important conference call on the evening of June 4th. The following day, Arias met up with Burns in the Salt Lake City suburb of West Jordan, Utah, and attended business meetings for the conference. Burns later said he noticed Arias' formerly blonde hair was now dark brown, and she had cuts on her hands. On June 6, she left Salt Lake City and drove west towards California. She called Alexander several times and left several voicemail messages for him. She also accessed his cell phone voicemail system. When Arias returned the car on June 7th, it had been driven about 2,800 miles. A rental clerk testified that the car was missing its floor mats and had red stains on its front and rear seats. It cannot be verified that the car had floor mats when Arias picked it up, and any stains could not be verified since the car was clean before police could examine it. On June 9th, having been unable to reach Alexander, a concerned group of friends went to his home. His roommates had not seen him for several days, but they believed he was out of town and thus did not think anything was amiss. After finding a key to Alexander's master bedroom, his friends entered and found a large pool of blood in the hallway to the master bathroom, where his body was discovered in the shower. In the 911 call not heard by the jury, the dispatcher asked if Alexander had been suicidal or if anyone was angry enough to hurt him. Alexander's friends specifically mentioned Arias as a possible suspect, saying that Alexander had said she was stalking him, accessing his Facebook account, and slashing his car's tires. While searching Alexander's home, police found his recently purchased digital camera damaged in the washing machine. Police were able to recover deleted images showing Arias and Alexander in sexually suggestive photos and poses taken at approximately 1:40 p.m. on June 4th. The final photograph of Alexander alive, showing him in the shower, was taken at 5:29 p.m. that day. Photos taken moments later show an individual believed to be Alexander profusely bleeding on the bathroom floor. A bloody palm print was discovered along the wall in the bathroom hallway. It contained DNA from both Arias and Alexander. On June 9, 2008, Arias was indicted by a grand jury in Maricopa County, Arizona, for the first-degree murder of Alexander. She was arrested at her home on the 15th of July and extradited to Arizona on September 5th. Arias pled not guilty on September 11th. During this time, she gave several different accounts about her involvement in Alexander's death. She originally told police she had not been in Mesa on the day of the murder and had last seen Alexander in March 2008. Arias later told police that two intruders had broken into Alexander's home, murdering him and attacking her. 2 years after her arrest, Arias told police that she killed Alexander in self-defense, claiming that she had been a victim of domestic violence. So we know more about what happened somewhat in that house. It's interesting that the story changes. I mean, one could argue that, you know, it was fear. And, you know, if she said she did it in self-defense, then she opens herself up to, you know, going to trial and having to prove that. And if she could pass it off as, you know, two people broke in and killed him, maybe they'll just accept that. I understand how someone would try and, you know, or would act that way in fear and say something like that. But ultimately, that's not going to benefit you.
But why and would you take pictures?
That's the fucked up part. I mean, that's where it's, you know, like, what are we doing, selfies with a body? I mean, what the fuck are we doing here?
And then forget that she didn't accidentally wash it? Or did she wash it on purpose, thinking that if she did that, then it would destroy any evidence? Like I don't know. At that point, why not just, you traveled 2,800 miles or something like that, throw the camera away somewhere.
Yeah.
There's a million places you could dispose of it.
The thing is, people,
other than in the washer, that's so weird.
It's one of those things where it's like, probably like a friend told her somewhere, you're like, oh, if you want to destroy the camera, if you got pictures on there, just throw that thing in the washer. That bitch ain't going to ever work again. And she thought, oh, my friend told me that in like a moment of like panic, and boom, it's in the washer. People do stupid shit like that all the time where it's like, I heard this, and it's like, what are you talking about to the rest of us? So I wonder, you know, what was going through one's mind when thinking that that's the best possible, you know, course of action.
But if you are also the person who just brutally murdered someone,
yeah,
you know, you might not be thinking straight.
That could be a good possibility there too, where you're like, well, yeah, we're just kind of desperately
like,
seeking
why
sanity.
Would you even take pictures anyway?
Yeah,
like I don't get any of it.
It's the, right. I don't know. I mean, I was going to say it's the generation, but it's not. She's actually a little bit older than me, technically. So it's not my generation that does all the overt picture things. That's kind of a little bit before me. But I don't know. I don't know what the hell that's all about. Narcissism? I don't know. I mean, to an extreme. Let's continue into the story and go into the pre-trial area. The Jody Arias story. On April 6th of 2009, a motion to reconsider the defendant's motion to disqualify the Maricopa County District Attorney's Office was denied. On May 18th, the court ordered Arias to submit to IQ and competency testing. Later in January 2011, a defense filing detailed Arias' attorney's efforts to obtain text messages and emails. The prosecution initially told defense attorneys that there were no available text messages sent or received by Alexander, and then was ordered to turn over several hundred such messages. Mesa Police Detectives Esteban Flores told defense attorneys that there was nothing out of the ordinary among Alexander's emails. About 8,000 were turned over to the defense in June of 2009. A trial commenced in Maricopa County Superior Court before Judge Sherry K. Stevens. Initial jury selection began on December 10th of 2012. During jury selection on December 20th, Arias' defense attorneys argued that the prosecution was systematically excluding women and African Americans. Prosecutor Juan Martinez said that race and sex were irrelevant in his discretion to strike certain jurors. Judge Stevens ruled that the prosecution had shown no bias in the jury selection. In opening arguments on January 2nd, 2013, Martinez sought the death penalty. Arias was represented by appointed counsel L. Kirk Nurmi and Jennifer Wilmot, who argued that Alexander's death was a justifiable homicide committed in self-defense. Co-worker Burns testified that when Arias visited him in Utah, the two had spent several hours hugging and kissing on a large beanbag chair. She told him she had cut her hands and broken glass while working at a restaurant called Margaritaville. A detective testified no restaurant by that name had ever existed in the Reykjavik area at the time. Arias was working at a restaurant called Casa Ramos. Arias later testified that after she cut her finger, I had a bazillion margaritas to make. Later, the prosecution argued that since a .25 caliber round was found near Alexander's body, that a gun of the same caliber was stolen from Arias' residence in Eureka the week before. She had staged the burglary and used a gun to kill Alexander. Martinez claimed Arias had stalked Alexander and had slashed his tires twice. In addition, in the final days before his death, Alexander had called her a sociopath and the worst thing that ever happened to me, and stated he was afraid of her. Arias took the stand in her own defense on February 4th of 2013, testifying for a total of 18 days. The length of time Arias spent on the stand was described by criminal defense attorney Mark Garagos as unprecedented. On the first day of her testimony, Arias told of being violently abused by her parents beginning when she was approximately 7 years old. She testified that she rented a car in Reading because Budget's website gave her two options, one to the north and one to the south, and her brother lived in Reading. On her second day on the stand, she said that her sex life with Alexander included oral and anal sex. She said that anal sex was painful for her the first time they experienced it together, and that while she considered these forms of sex to be real sex, Alexander did not, as they were supposedly not against Mormon rules concerning vaginal intercourse. Arya said that they eventually had intercourse, but less often. A phone sex tape was played in which Alexander said he wanted to zip tie Arias to a tree and have anal sex with her while she was dressed as Little Red Riding Hood, while Arias seemed to respond to enthusiastically. Arias has recorded this phone sex session without Alexander's knowledge or consent, apparently hoping to use it to embarrass Alexander to his Mormon peers. Arias also testified that Alexander had secretly found young boys and girls sexually attractive and that she tried to help him with these urges. Forensic experts testified that an examination of Alexander's computer found no evidence of pornographic material. Arias testified that her relationship with Alexander became increasingly physical and emotionally abusive. She said that Alexander shook her while saying, "I'm fucking sick of you," and began screaming at me, after which he body slammed me on the floor at the foot of his bed and taunted her, saying, "Don't act like that hurts," before he called her a bitch and kicked her in the ribs. Afterward, Arias said he went to kick me again and I put my hand out. Arias held up her left hand in the courtroom, showing that her ring finger was crooked. According to Arias, the dysfunction of their relationship reached its climax when she killed him in self-defense after he became enraged when she dropped his camera, forcing her to fight for her life. This was the third different account of Alexander's death given by Arias, which both prosecutors, courtroom observers, and later jurors felt severely damaged her credibility. Rebuttal witnesses from the prosecution included several of Alexander's other girlfriends who stated he never exhibited any problems with anger or violence. Arias addressed comments she made in a September 2008 interview with the syndicated news program Inside Edition, which had been played earlier in the trial. In the interview, she said, "No jury is going to convict me because I am innocent. You can mark my words on that." Discussing the statement during her testimony, Arias said, "At the time of the interview, I had plans to commit suicide, so I was extremely confident that no jury would convict me because I didn't expect any of you to be here." At the close of his cross-examination of Arias, Martinez replayed the video and prompted Arias to affirm that she had said during the interview that she would not be convicted because she was innocent. And being questioned by Martinez, Arias was initially combative and flippant, but after several days, Martinez was able to highlight the numerous lies and inconsistencies in her testimony, and she admitted to stabbing and shooting Alexander despite her earlier claims of a lapse in her memory. The jury's foreman, William Zervokas, later expressed an opinion common to both jurors and observers when he told ABC's Good Morning America that Arias' testimony did not do her any good. I think 18 days hurt her. I think she was not a good witness. Starting March 14th, psychologist Richard Samuels testified for the defense for nearly 6 days. He said Arias was likely suffering from acute stress at the time of the murder, sending her body into a fight-or-flight mode to defend herself, which caused her brain to stop retaining memory. In response to a juror's question asking whether this scenario could occur, even if this was a premeditated murder, as the prosecution contended, he responded, "Is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? No." Samuels also diagnosed Arias with post-traumatic stress disorder. Martinez attacked Samuels' credibility, accusing him of forming a relationship with Arias and being biased. Samuels had previously testified he had compassion for Arias. Beginning on March 26, Alyssa Lavotti, a psychotherapist who specializes in domestic violence, testified that Arias was a victim of domestic abuse and that most victims do not tell anyone about abuse because they feel ashamed and humiliated. Lavotti summarized emails from Alexander's close friends. They basically advised Ms. Arias to move on from the relationship, that Mr. Alexander had been abusive to women. The jury posed nearly 160 questions to Lavotte, many of them focusing on Arias' credibility. Clinical psychologist Janine DeMart testified for the prosecution, stating that she found no evidence Alexander had abused Arias and no evidence of PTSD or amnesia in Arias. Furthermore, Arias' claimed total memory loss for long stretches of time was inconsistent with traumatic amnesia associated with PTSD, which manifests as much shorter gaps in memory. Instead, DeMart said Arias suffered from borderline personality disorder, showing signs of immaturity and an unstable sense of identity. People who suffer from such a disorder have a terrified feeling of being abandoned by others. DeMart told jurors, the final defense witness was psychologist Robert Geffner, who said that DeMarte's borderline diagnosis was not appropriate and that all tests taken by Arias since her arrest pointed towards an anxiety disorder stemming from trauma. He also said the test indicated that she answered questions honestly without lying. Following Geffner's testimony, the state recalled Horn, who testified further on the gunshot wound, and called Jill Hayes, a forensic neuropsychologist who disputed Geffner's testimony, that the MMPI test was not geared towards diagnosing borderline personality disorder, concluding a long day in court at 8:29 p.m. On April 24th, in response to previous testimony given by Arias about buying a 5-gallon gas can from Walmart stores in Salinas on June 3, 2008, that she returned on the same day, the prosecution called Amanda Webb, an employee from the only Walmart there, to take the stand. Webb said that according to Walmart's records, no one returned a 5-gallon gas can on that date, and Arias returned the gas can a week later rather than on June 3rd. The gas can evidence was seen as important in establishing premeditation, as the prosecutor argued that Arias was trying to avoid being recorded on gas station security cameras as she drove to Mesa. In closing arguments on May 4th, Arias' defense argued that the premeditation theory did not make sense. What happened in that moment in time, the relationship of chaos, that ended in chaos as well. There's nothing about that relationship, about what happened on June 4th in that bathroom that looked planned. Couldn't it also be that after everything they went through in that relationship, that she simply snapped? Ultimately, if Miss Arias is guilty of a crime at all, it's a crime of manslaughter and nothing more. In rebuttal, Martinez described the extent and variety of Alexander's wounds. There's no evidence that he ever laid a hand on her, ever. Nothing indicates that this is anything less than slaughter. There's no way to appease this woman who just wouldn't leave him alone, he said. Arias' testimony added to a very long defense portion of guilt, the guilt phase of the trial, which led to problems with retention of jury members. On April 3rd, a member of the jury was dismissed for misconduct. The defense team asked for a mistrial, which the judge denied. On April 12th, another juror was excused for health reasons. A third juror was dismissed on April 25th after being arrested for a DUI offense. As of April 25th, defense costs had reached almost $1.7 million paid by taxpayers. On May 7th, 2013, after 15 hours of deliberation, Arias was found guilty of first-degree murder. Out of 12 jurors, 5 jurors found her guilty of first-degree premeditated murder, and 7 jurors found her guilty of both first-degree premeditated murder and felony murder. And the guilty verdict was read. Alexander's family smiled and hugged each other. People outside the courtroom began cheering and chanting. Following the conviction, the prosecution was required to convince a jury that the murder was cruel, heinous, or deprived in order for them to determine that Arias was eligible for the death penalty. The aggravation phase of the trial started on May 15, 2013. The only witness was a medical examiner who performed the autopsy. Arias' attorneys, who had repeatedly asked to step down from the case, gave only brief opening statements and closing arguments in which they said the adrenaline rushing through Alexander's body may have prevented him from feeling much pain during his death. Prosecutor Martinez showed photos of the corpse and crime scene to the jury and paused for 2 minutes of silence to illustrate how long he said it took for Alexander to die in Arias' hands. After less than 3 hours of consideration, the jury determined that Arias was eligible for the death penalty. Well, there you go.
She's delightful.
Just delightful.
You know what I find so... There's so many things that really bother me about this story.
Yeah?
But the fact that his family and friends had to sit in that courtroom and listen to the shit that she was saying. You know, she said some... really bad things about him.
Yeah.
Like into child pornography and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and nothing was substantiated. She's just trying to make him look bad.
That's, yeah. And
and supposedly that gun was stolen a week before this happened. You know, that's premeditation. Obviously, it's something she'd been thinking about.
Yeah.
In the gas can. And maybe she didn't go there with, I'm going to kill him, but maybe she was going there with, I might just kill him.
And then she's got a plan for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a way and a path in case. No matter what. Yeah.
Either he gets back with me or I have to kill him.
Black or white. Black. Yeah. And that's the only options. It's scary. You know, what someone is capable of. And you know, when they can argue it such a way that almost kind of makes you believe, but then it's like, wait a second. And you put some of it together and it's, and then just the lengths, like you're saying that she went to, just saying these heinous things about him and they got to sit there and listen and hear that. And it's like, really? Yeah. It's a fucked up case. Let's continue into the penalty phase area of the Jody Arias story. The penalty phase began on May 16, 2013, when prosecutors called Alexander's family members to offer victim impact statements in an effort to convince the jury that Arias' crime merited a death sentence. On May 21st, Arias offered an allocation during which she pled for a life sentence. Arias acknowledged that her plea for life was a reversal of remarks she made to a TV reporter shortly after her conviction, when she said she prefaced the death penalty, "Each time I said that, I meant it. But I lacked perspective," she said. "Until very recently, I could not imagine standing before you and asking you to give me life." She said she changed her mind to avoid bringing more pain to members of her family who were in the courtroom. At one point, she held up a white T-shirt with the word "Survivor" written across it, telling the jurors that she would sell the clothing and donate all proceeds to victims of domestic abuse. She also said she would donate her hair to Locks of Love while in prison, and had already done so 3 times while in jail. That evening, in a joint jailhouse interview with the Arizona Republic, KPNX-TV, and NBC's Today, Arya said she did not know whether the jury would come back with life or death. "Whatever they come back with, I'll have to deal with it. I have no other choice." Regarding the verdict, she said, "It felt like a huge sense of unreality. I felt betrayed, actually, by the jury. I was hoping they would see things for what they are. I felt really awful for my family and what they were thinking." On May 23rd, the sentencing phase of Arias' trial resulted in a hung jury, prompting the judge to declare a mistrial for that phase. The jury had reached an 8-4 decision in favor of the death penalty. After the jury was discharged, jury foreman Zervokas stated that the jury found the responsibility of weighing the death sentence overwhelming, but were horrified when the efforts ended in a mistrial. By the end of it, we were mentally and emotionally exhausted, he said. I think we were horrified when we found out that they had actually called a mistrial, and we felt like we had failed. On May 30th, Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery discussed the next steps at a news conference. He said he was confident an impartial jury could be seated, but it was possible that lawyers and the victim's family could agree to scrap the trial in favor of a life sentence with no parole. Arias had said, I don't think there's an untainted jury pool anywhere in the world right now. That's what it feels like, but I still believe in the system to a degree, so we'll just go through that if that happens. The defense attorney responded, if the diagnosis made by the state psychologist is correct, the Maricopa County's attorney's office is seeking to impose the death penalty upon a mentally ill woman who has no prior criminal history. It's not incumbent upon Ms. Arias' defense counsel to resolve this case. During the trial, defense attorneys filed for a mistrial in January, April, and May 2013. Arias' lawyers argued in January that Esteban Flores, the lead Mesa police detective on the case, perjured himself during a 2008 pretrial hearing aimed at determining whether the death penalty should be considered an option for jurors. Flores testified in 2009 hearing that, based on his own review of the scene and discussion with the medical examiner, it was apparent that Alexander had been shot in the forehead first. Contrary to Flores' testimony at the 2009 hearing, the medical examiner told jurors a gunshot probably would have impacted Alexander, given his extensive defense wounds, including stab marks and slashes to his hands, arms, and legs. It was not likely that the shot came first. Flores denied perjury and said during his trial testimony that he misunderstood what the medical examiner told him. In April, the defense claimed the prosecutor had acted inappropriately and said the case resembled a modern-day equivalent to the Salem witch trials. In the motion, the defense team contended the prosecutorial misconduct has infested these proceedings with a level of unfairness that cannot be cured by any other means. The motion also stated there is a circus-like atmosphere inside the courtroom and that Martinez had yelled at witnesses, attacked witnesses on a personal level, and had thrown evidence. The motion also alleged that Martinez chose to release evidence and to pose for pictures with his fans on the steps of the courthouse. The attorney claimed Arias was in a position in which she could not present a complete defense and that the only constitutional course was to declare a mistrial. On May 20th, 2013, defense attorneys filed a motion which alleged that a defense witness who had been due to testify in the proceedings Friday the 17th began receiving death threats for her scheduled testimony on Arias' behalf. The day before the filing, the witness contacted counsel for Arias, stating that she was no longer willing to testify because of the threats. The motion continued, it should also be noted that these threats follow those made to Alice Livote, a record of which was made ex parte under seal. The motion was denied, and was the motion for a stay in the proceedings that had been sought to give time to appeal the decisions to the Arizona Supreme Court. On May 29, 2013, the Arizona Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal filed 3 months earlier, also refused by the mid-level Arizona Court of Appeals. Nurmi had asked the high court to throw out the aggravating factor of cruelty because the judge had allowed it to go forward based on a different theory of how the murder occurred. The lead detective originally claimed that the gunshot occurred first, followed by the stabbing and slitting of the throat. Based on that theory, Stevens ruled there was probable cause to find the crime had been committed in an especially cruel manner, an aggravating factor under state law. Subsequent to the initial hearing, the medical examiner testified that the gunshot occurred post-mortem. On January 6, 2018, Arias's current attorneys, Margaret M. Green and Corey Eagle, filed a 324-page appeal seeking her murder conviction be overturned to the Court of Appeals. On October 17, 2019, Arias's attorneys argued to the Court of Appeals that her sentence should be overturned on the basis that Martinez acted inappropriately throughout the trial, resulting in a media frenzy and affecting the outcome of the trial. On March 24, 2020, the court held that, notwithstanding egregious and self-promoting misconduct by the prosecutor, Arias had been convicted based upon the overwhelming evidence of her guilt and upheld the conviction. So there you go. That's where it sits right now.
God, I forgot all of that.
And like, it could still...
back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And you know, and there's still the families. And I feel bad for her family too.
Yeah.
Like, there's just so many other people's lives involved in this.
There is. And
it's all, and it just, for her, it's just all about, and I get, you know, she's going to prison or she's going to die, but you committed a horrific murder.
That's where you have to start wondering, does she realize what she's done, or is that, does she believe that she's innocent? Does she believe
she's crazy like a fox? And
sure.
I think she's trying to do whatever it takes to get out of it, that her plan to get away with it didn't work.
Yeah.
So then she's going to do anything else and blame anybody else. And that whole going to court with that survivor t-shirt.
Yeah.
Like, now after all that, she brutally murdered him and then is claiming that he abused her.
Yeah. And the thing,
and there's no evidence of that, you know, and that makes me mad, because there are people, women, who suffer abuse every day.
It's like just shitting on that. And
yeah.
Saying like, I'm in
and
this
it's
group.
So disrespectful to what women are really fighting against.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, look, here's an angle for me. No. Like, it just pisses me off.
What a messed up story.
What a messed up woman.
Yeah. It's a dark one, and one that, you know, you look at it and you go, my God. It's a reflection, though, as well, when you really look at it, of our modern society and our lack of adequate mental health care in our world. You know, we care far more about cosmetic things half the time than we do about our minds, you know, and there's far more passion for things like that than our minds. And
I think with somebody like her, though, there's some people that are just, you know, maybe if she'd have gotten help much earlier in her life.
Yeah. And she'd have to realize that there was something wrong as well.
Exactly.
And not, that doesn't always happen. And that's obviously step number one for someone like that to get better. And clearly, she, even if she did realize that, she never spoke it out loud to get that help. And
but even that, I just have a hard time when everything is so calculated on the before the murder and after. You know, it's
crazy as shit.
She
but
just kept throwing things at the wall to see what was going to stick.
It's calculated crazy is what.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean that the illness isn't there. It just means
it's dead. And she's pulling the focus away from that. It's all about her.
It's running the show.
And this poor person, this man is dead. Brutally. Like, you know, if he was shot in the head before or after his throat was cut, like, that's horrific.
Yeah.
And she took pictures.
Kodak moments, Carol. Kodak moments.
I want to remember this.
Half of the audience knows that phrase, half doesn't know.
Exactly.
It used to be said, when you took a picture on a physical piece of, you know, film, it's a Kodak moment. But that's not said anymore. God, it's just freaky shit.
There are people right now that are going film.
And I think Bill Cosby was the one promoting it, wasn't he? Wasn't he a Kodak spokesperson too?
I don't remember. I know he sold pudding.
Pudding. He was on all sorts of shit. Like Kodak Mo. I don't. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought I have like a memory of Bill Cosby on that. So it's like,
I had a really hard time with that whole. That's a whole nother episode of this show that we should.
Yes.
Go into sometime.
Yes, we totally should. That'd
because
be a great
I
one.
Really had a hard time with it because I really liked Bill Cosby.
Sure.
You know, and
everyone
I still see
did.
Pictures of him. And I want to just like him and hug him and be like, hey. And then I'm like, my God, he's not even kind of the person we thought he was.
What will be interesting about him is how the Cosby Show lives in on-demand presence. I mean, it was all like yanked and pulled when, you know, all that came out. But I see it back. It's popped up. If you went to some player, you'd be able to find the Cosby Show to watch. But, you know, and besides all the facts that we know about him, you know, people still listen to R. Kelly. People still will watch the Cosby Show now. Even like Roseanne, that got pulled, you know, all those episodes. But now they're all back everywhere on streaming platforms. You know, and so they're not the to put that in the
but
category.
But I mean, Roseanne is kind of different.
It is different.
You might not agree with stuff that she did, but she didn't murder anybody.
You're right. I don't agree.
She didn't rape anybody.
And I just thought of that. I'm like, I'm not, I shouldn't put that in the same category. Wrong with what someone may have said, or agree or disagree, whatever it is, but she wasn't a fucking murderer.
Right.
You know, or rapist or, you know, something like that. I'm just kind of making examples of celebrities that have kind of had the fallout and then.
Yeah.
It kind of comes back. Michael Jackson, again, not convicted, but there's a shitload of fucking evidence and weird stories out there that really.
I remember when Michael Jackson died. You were the person who told me.
Yeah, I remember being.
I'll never forget that. That's how I found out. You told me.
And it was literally 5 o'clock. Me and a coworker of ours, Phil White, at the time, he was doing news and it had just come across over TMZ. TMZ broke the story and we were sitting there like literally. It was, you know, 60 seconds to air. Do we go and say that? Because TMZ at the time, not such a reliable source. And it's like, we went with it. So he read it. And then our boss at the time running down the hall. Don't put that up. Don't say
three sources.
This is not the source. And then like 20 seconds later, it's like ABC, NBC, CBS confirms. It's like, yeah, we kind of knew he was dead. But yeah. We still joke about that at times, but yeah, it's interesting. That's, I think, going to wrap up our episode today of the dark side of Wikipedia.
Let's do it when I'm Bill Cosby.
Yeah, well, I'll get that into the queue. That should be okay. A fun one. Yeah, it'll be good. And watch, with our luck, the day that this airs and drops, he like died or something.
But
at this point, when you're a convicted rapist and shit, I really don't give a shit. So that's going to wrap up today's episode of the show. If you like the program, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate that. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.